remembering the lost landscape of childhood.
I'm trying for a sort of mythical tone. I think we all have a tone, an atmosphere, a memory of childhood that's more like a musical tone. And though you might not remember each exchange of dialogue, you do remember the general atmosphere.
That's Joyce Carol Oates. She's out with a wonderful new memoir, The Lost Landscape, A Writer's Coming of Age. That's up first on today's Writer's Voice. Then we replay an edited version of my 2014 interview with novelist Ann Patchett about her book of essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Joyce Carol Oates is one of America's most loved and most prolific writers. She's penned about 70 books in her long career and won numerous awards, including the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, and the National Humanities Medal. But in her new memoir, The Lost Landscape, Oates reveals that her life as a writer is the product of an accident of fate. She could as easily have become instead a schoolteacher in some small, hardscrabble town in western New York where she grew up. Joyce Carol Oates was the first member of her family to go past the eighth grade, way past, we may add. She grew up on a small farm owned by her Hungarian immigrant grandparents. Both her grandfather and father were factory workers. Her mother and grandmother stayed home and tended the farm. Money was always tight, and the chores were constant. But, as she tells us in The Lost Landscape, it was a good life. Sheltered within the loving arms of her family, Joyce Carol Oates developed an inspired imagination filled with deep questions about the world around her, and a powerful drive to tell stories that illumined it. The Lost Landscape tells the story of her coming of age as a writer, from her childhood on that farm in rural western New York until her launching as a celebrated novelist. I spoke to her at the Mysterious Bookshop in Manhattan.
Well, Joyce Carol Oates, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Joyce, this was just such a wonderful book to read. I read it with immense pleasure from start to finish. And it started with the very first sentence, which I wonder if you could read for me. It's only one sentence on one page, and for me it set the tone of the whole book.
We begin as children, imagining and fearing ghosts. By degrees, through our long lives, we come to be the very ghosts inhabiting the lost landscapes of our childhood.
Yes, you write that no romance is so profound and enduring as the romance of early childhood. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. What do you mean by the romance of early childhood?
Well, obviously, when we're very young children, we have virtually no memories. We're creating our memories, and all of our experiences are so vivid and so thrilling and exciting, and we're just filled with all sorts of emotions. I remember as a child, I'd be very, very excited. I would fall down and hurt and cut my leg, and I'd cry. And then a few minutes later, I would have forgotten about it. Everything was turbulent and in a turmoil, sort of like a windstorm or a whirlpool. And so I think that we're creating our personalities out of these disparate sensory experiences.
And those early experiences were in northern New York. You grew up on a farm way upstate in New York State. Give us a snapshot of where you grew up.
We lived north of Buffalo, about 20 miles north of Buffalo, in what is called the Snow Belt. And it is really, really the Snow Belt. It was south of Lake Ontario. We had a small farm. Our main produce was Bartlett pears and some other fruit, some apples and cherries, and chickens and eggs. That was mainly it. It was not a very prosperous farm.
This was a farm that was established by your mother's parents, actually step-parents. I love the way you speak about your family in this book. They were, seemed to me, a most unusual family, although they probably were not really all that unusual given the context of the American story of immigration.
Yes, I think that's true. And one of the reasons I wanted to write about my parents and my grandparents is that they seem to be exemplary, representative of their generations. They were, my grandparents came from Europe, and my parents were more or less incapacitated, I guess you could say, by the Depression. They had to quit school when they were very young. My father was, and I think he was about 13 years old. My mother was about the same age. They had to quit school so young to go to work.
There was a lot of tragedy, though, in their early lives. And one of the things that you do in this wonderful book, The Lost Landscape, A Writer's Coming of Age, one of the things you do in the book is to wonder how such traumatic early lives, how they could have survived it, survived those lives and gone on to be such basically kind and caring and upstanding people. Talk a little bit about the turbulent early lives of your family.
It is somewhat of a mystery to me. My father was the son of a man who was an alcoholic, and he was abusive of his family. He left my grandmother when my father was quite young. I don't remember, he could have been 10 or 11 years old. So that family sort of broke up. And then my mother had been given away when she was just an infant because her family couldn't afford to keep her. There were 9 children. Her father had been murdered in a tavern fight. I mean, I don't really want to emphasize all these sort of horrific, melodramatic things because I didn't really know these things when I was growing up. I found out much later. And I think many families have secrets they just don't talk about. My parents were very protective of my brother and me. They didn't really want to distress us.
That's true. I mean, you grew up almost, one could say in some ways, almost an idyllic childhood. You had a rather fierce grandmother, however, and in some ways a rather fierce grandfather. These are marvelously painted portraits in your book. Your grandmother was Hungarian. Well, your grandparents were Hungarian. Also, quite extraordinary people. Talk a little bit about both of them and their impact and influence on you when you were so young.
My grandfather was quite a character. He was a village blacksmith. He was very, very physically large and imposing. He had a beard, a kind of bristling beard. And he worked partly in, part of the time he worked in a factory in Tonawanda, because the farm didn't really make enough money to support us. And my father also worked in a factory in Lockport. So we lived with my mother's step-parents, and these were my Hungarian grandparents. So my Hungarian grandmother was a person who was completely unsentimental. She's very practical. She was the slaughterer of the chickens, and she basically was, I suppose you could say, a peasant, like a European peasant. That word may not be used much today, but she was a person who never learned to speak English because she thought it wasn't necessary. She was 18 years old when she came to the United States, and she thought she was too old. And my grandfather learned English a little bit, but they were these characters. When I look back upon them, they were really, in a way, like mythic figures. And when I think of my grandfather especially, I feel a kind of bittersweet, nostalgic memory because though he teased me and made me cry, when he was only 53 years old, evidently, of course I thought he was much older, he died of maybe of emphysema from working in this factory, or it may have been lung cancer. I don't really know. I was very young when he died. It was actually terrifying to see this person who had once been so physically strong and imposing suddenly coughing and coughing blood. And he finally just collapsed, and he died shortly afterward.
Yeah, a work-related disease.
Work-related, that's true. But those words didn't exist then. He would have thought that he was very lucky to get that job.
And in fact, one of the things I appreciated in this book was the way you talk about the working class, you know, lives of the people in the town that you grew up, and even of this. I mean, for many years, I taught occupational health and safety, and it's something that people never think of, and yet everybody works.
Yes. Well, especially in the 1950s, no one thought of that. Mm-hmm. Everyone was smoking constantly. Even my mother smoked, maybe not so much as the others, but my grandfather smoked horrible cigarettes that he made himself.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, you're hearing my interview with acclaimed writer Joyce Carol Oates about her new memoir, The Lost Landscape.
Now, your grandmother and your grandfather really come alive in what I think is my very favorite chapter. This one is the second chapter in the book. It's titled Happy Chicken, 1942 to 1944. It's ostensibly written in first-person chicken. So tell us about Happy Chicken and also why you chose this point of view to speak about him.
When I was a really little girl, maybe 2 or 3 years old, I had this pet chicken, or rather the chicken just sort of emerged and was a very friendly chicken. And I guess my mother encouraged me to pet the chicken. And the chicken really was like a pet. It was quite remarkable. And so this was Happy Chicken, my chicken. And I took the chicken around with me and played with the chicken. I took the chicken indoors and fed him special treats. The funny thing is that though the chicken was obviously a hen, we all called him a he. It was like a little boy. And I never understood that. I mean, when you're a child, you don't question. So I wanted to write about myself between the ages of 2 and 6 when certain things happen in my family. But I couldn't really write from the point of view of the little girl because she didn't really know what was going on. So I chose to write from the point of view of Happy Chicken, who has sort of a mythic power to look into the future. And he has a mythic awareness of where the farm is and the sort of geographical sense of what it looks like from the air.
There's also this sense in the story that I could certainly relate to, the sense of, in childhood, something that little Joyce both loves his chicken and fears for him. There's kind of a bit of a looming sense of danger that goes throughout this chapter.
Yes, I was both aware and deliberately not aware of all the violence in nature. There were foxes and raccoons and wandering stray dogs who might kill the chickens, so the chickens had to be protected. And sometimes wandering through a field or an orchard, one would find a dead animal. And I can remember how scary that was and how we would run away, you know, just sort of hide our eyes and run away. And I wasn't really aware of the chickens being killed, but I guess they must have been killed because we were eating chicken. As my parents pointed out to me, Joyce, you ate chicken. And I would say, I did. You know, after I grew up, because I don't really remember that. It's very strange.
Yeah, and you say that you must have seen your grandmother, because wasn't it her job to dispatch the chickens?
Well, I really can remember them in the kitchen pulling feathers off the chickens, and I can remember the terrible smell of the very hot water where you put the chickens in to loosen the feathers. And I can remember all that, and yet I don't have a continuity. It's like I'm not really there. It's like some amnesia just sweeps over my brain. And I was always afraid that something would happen to Happy Chicken. But I don't honestly know what did happen to Happy Chicken. It's just like there's a blank.
Yes, and then the very last part of that chapter, Happy Chicken has disappeared. And in his voice, there's a wonderful story that you tell on the very last page of that chapter of what happened to Happy Chicken.
Well, in fantasy, the chicken is allowed to fly away. He just says, I learned how to fly. And he flies higher and higher, and he can see the farm from high above and the little chickens and the farmhouse and the barn and all that. He flies away. So it's just sort of a symbol, I guess, of losing one's childhood. And eventually we all fly away and leave home. But when I began writing that memoir, it was very loving and wonderful, but then by the time I ended it, it was very, very tearful, and I always sort of start crying when I get to the end of it.
Yes, and I even thought that it was kind of a story that little Joyce might have told herself, to make herself, as you have done, use stories to, you know, how we tell stories, we tell the stories about our life, and you, above all, as the writer that you are, how you process your life through the telling of the story.
Yes, I think that's true. Joan Didion said something very similar to that, that we tell ourselves stories in order to live. The stories, though, don't always have the cathartic effect. Sometimes in writing a memoir, you really stir up emotions and memories that are very powerful. So I feel a sort of gravitational pull toward the past, and I worry, you know, that I didn't really do enough and should have done more. Or it's just a sense of residual guilt, I guess.
You mean should have done more as you look back on the things that happened and feel I should have done this and not have done that?
It's hard to say. Whenever you write a memoir, you're selecting and you're not putting everything in. And I have very partial portraits of everyone. I didn't really know enough about my grandparents. I was fairly young when my grandfather died. I didn't really have a curiosity that would seem normal. I just accepted that these people were my grandparents. It never dawned on me that they were actually human beings with their own histories. And later on, when I got older, I became very interested in my parents' lives. I've written a lot about my parents. But, you know, just to survive, and I'm also a widow. Many widows, I think, feel a guilt just about surviving.
And you've written a book about becoming a widow. Was that not a cathartic experience for you?
No, I wouldn't say it was cathartic. In a way, I don't know what catharsis means. I know what it means intellectually, but I'm not sure that I've ever had a cathartic experience. Going deeply into any area of life stirs emotion. People who are on the surface and who just breeze along and don't look back and are not really introspective, they don't really need cathartic experiences. So I wouldn't say that was a cathartic experience. I find it very hard to open my memoir or to open my journal. I can't really look at them anymore. It just is too painful.
Does it become more painful through the writing of it?
It's more looking back. Like if I open my journal, which was published, like to something that took place in 1977, I might be writing about my parents visiting and my husband Raymond and, you know, things that happened on that day. And when I wrote it, it was all alive and wonderful and exciting, and I didn't know it would come in the future. But now when I look back on it, it's all finished, and so there's a sadness about it. I think the only writing of mine that I feel comfortable looking back on is the writing that's purely fiction, where it's basically the energy of the drama and a narrative, where I can just read it. But when I read anything that has a memoirist content to it, that's very, very painful, because I can remember the reality, and I can remember how things have changed. And it's just very, very, very painful.
You write a lot in this book about the process of writing memoir. You say that it's fraught with peril. Is that some of what you've just been talking about?
Yes, I think so. I haven't really talked with other people who've written memoirs, though I'm friendly with Tobias Wolff and Mary Carr and Edmund White, they've all written memoirs, and I've never really talked about this aspect of it. And my parents are no longer living. My brother is living, and I dedicated the book to him. But he hasn't said much about the memoir. It's possible that he has many conflicting memories or he feels ambivalent. He's not a person who is a literary person, so maybe he just hasn't said anything. But I'm sort of waiting to hear what he has to say.
You also have a lovely phrase in here. You say that we live things under a microscope, but we look back on them through a telescope.
Yes, we live our lives minute by minute, and the most minutiae just completely absorbs us, like what do we have for dinner tonight, and will I make dinner and go shopping. And my life is completely filled. Every minute is filled with something that I'm doing. I'm usually very busy. I have a household and I'm teaching and traveling. I have two cats. I have a husband. So my life is sort of stuffed with this keeping things going. But then when you look back on a life, you look back on a day in 1977 or 1989, the whole day is just like, it's gone. And you might remember one thing about it that's very flat. It's like a postcard that's put on a wall, and there's like one image from the whole day. So it's a kind of vertiginous experience to look back in that way.
We're talking with Joyce Carol Oates about her wonderful new memoir, The Lost Landscape. It tells the story of her coming of age as a writer from her childhood in rural western New York State until her launching as a celebrated novelist.
Also, it seems to me that in memoir, I mean, of course, we have a very selective memory, and it's also only our memory. I mean, it's, you know, kind of, I think of Rashomon, you know, we each have our own experience of the world. Is that an issue when you have to think of the other people that you're writing about?
Well, I make it pretty clear in my afterword about that I think that the memoir is pretty much partially imagined. I don't claim that these things are objective. Certainly the chapter that's told by Happy Chicken, you know, can't be too realistic. I'm trying for a sort of mythical tone. I think we all have a tone, an atmosphere, a memory of childhood that's more like a musical tone. And though you might not remember each exchange of dialogue, you do remember the general atmosphere.
You've talked about the painfulness of going back into childhood, but isn't there also a yearning? I mean, that certainly comes through in your book, a nostalgia.
Yes, it's very powerful nostalgia. And there were a lot, many, many happy things that did happen, and I remember them in sort of vivid images, sort of quick cuts, as in a movie, just quick images. Mm-hmm. That's very true.
Yeah, and it seems also that you're turning things over and examining them from different facets. Certainly your parents in the beginning of the book, your parents are seen more from a young child's perspective. And at the end of the book, you know, you're remembering them now as an adult. They really come forward at the end of the book, your mother and your father, as such admirable human beings.
Yes, I even interviewed my mother for Oprah magazine, and there's a fairly long chapter on the different clothes my mother made for me and things that she sewed for me. In fact, I'm wearing this very beautiful top that my mother sewed right now, and the things that my father did, and there's quite a long chapter on my father. He was a strong character and a very interesting man, and everyone who knew him really liked him. He was an interesting personality. If he had not had to drop out of school when he was 13, I'm sure he would have gone to college and maybe become a teacher, a high school teacher, maybe even a college teacher.
Now, you're the first person in your family to go to college, even to go beyond the eighth grade. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And that was very wonderful that my parents encouraged me. And there was never any sense that they felt I was getting beyond them, which is sometimes a consequence of people from this, you know, this background. Sometimes it's said to a young person that you don't want to get ahead of yourself or you get too smart for your own good. But I would never had that. My parents thought that I would be a teacher, and I wanted to be a high school teacher for a while.
Yeah, and one of the things that you kind of turn around and examine in the book is the quirks of fate, as you call them. I mean, really quite extraordinary how your life veered into, I mean, it almost seems like predestination, and yet you also talk of it as such an accident.
It seems to me like an accident, a series of accidents. It's so strange because I went to a really, really bad school, a one-room schoolhouse, though I liked it. I didn't know any better. But it was probably not a very good situation. Then I went by Greyhound bus to a Lockport school, to a middle school, and that probably wasn't too wonderful either. But then just by accident, the school district got reorganized, and I was sent quite a long distance by school bus to Williamsville, a suburb of Buffalo. And suddenly I was in a really good school district, and then my classmates were going to go to Harvard or Princeton or Yale. It was just like night and day. I went from Lockport to Williamsville. And my whole life was changed by having a different school system and different teachers.
You also talk of another quirk of fate, which is when you went to college. Just must have been not more than a month at school, you met your husband, and that was another really extraordinary quirk of faith. How did meeting your husband change your life? I mean, other than obviously you got married, but how did it veer it into a different direction?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I've thought about it quite a bit. I don't really know that we can talk about alternative lives, like if you didn't meet someone, or if you went, it's like Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. If you went in a different way, would you have a completely different life or just a slightly different life? Now, people who know me just laugh at me and they say, well, I would always have been a writer, no matter where I'd gone to school. And they just think that I'm ridiculous to say that it's all based on luck. But to me, it just feels like luck, like a shake of the dice. But other people say that, and they say, well, Joyce, you've written 70 books. It can't just be luck. You must have had some, you know, drive or predilection or talent to do this. Now, that might be true, but it doesn't feel that way to me. To me, it feels like good luck.
You feel like you've been very fortunate in life.
I don't know that I've been very fortunate. It's all relative, but until maybe fairly recently, I've been very lucky. I have to say that when my husband died in 2008, that was like the collapse of my life. That was a devastation. But it's probably not any different from losing any loved one in any family. It's just that it was quite devastating.
Do you think as a writer you have to have a thinner skin, more of an ability to, in fact, be struck and to be hurt and to feel pain?
That might be. That's a good question. It might be. Maybe. I do have a number of poet friends who just seem to be very sensitive and very alert to things that other people might not notice. That's so true. At the same time, I thought you were going to say, do you think you have to have a thick skin because you have to endure being reviewed and being misread or sometimes very, very meanly reviewed by people who misread your writing. So you have to be a combination, almost impossible, being thin-skinned or sensitive, and then in other ways being thick-skinned.
And have you been able to achieve that thick skin when you needed it?
I don't know, really. Sometimes I feel very vulnerable. And I think since my husband died in 2008, I have felt much more vulnerable. But I have kept going. And I think maybe that's a quality that artists have and actors. An actor, for instance, has to go out on stage. He or she has to perform. Maybe the spouse has died, the father has died, there's a diagnosis of cancer. But you walk out on stage and you fulfill your obligation and you do the performance. So I think that I have that sense instilled in me that I do the performance, and then maybe when it's all done, then there's a collapse. But then I come back for another performance.
And we're very lucky that you do so. Now, some people that you write about, not just in this book, but in others of your books, undergo terrible tragedies. One of them was a next-door neighbor. Another one was a best friend. But of the next-door neighbor, this was there was the Judd family. I don't know how much you actually want to talk about what happened, but I was very interested by one of the things you said. This was a family where there was a fair amount of abuse going on. And you say that, you know, the other people in the town, they saw the Judds as isolated and pathetic. They thought of them as people who, as you say, could tell us nothing about ourselves. In other words, they were the other. Yeah. But you say that they actually tell us everything about ourselves. What do you mean by that?
Well, even when I was very young, I felt that the girl next door was like a sister to me, and that the things that were happening to her and her family could easily have happened to me, except I had this wonderful father. She had a terrible father. Her mother was nice. Her mother worked in a factory. But her father was an alcoholic. And he really beat and harassed and molested the children and abused them. There weren't such terms as domestic violence in those days. Even the word harassment and molestation, I don't think those words existed. So a man out in the rural community in his own house, he could virtually do anything to his children. And this man, I remember, shot his dog when he was drunk, and the poor dog crawled under the house and died. And we had to hear this poor dog whining and whimpering for hours. And it was sort of like a nightmare. But I remember at the time that I felt so sorry for the girl next door. Now I've changed their names and I've given them different names because the children were kind of nice. There were a number of children, and some of them I got to know, of course, fairly well. But I always remember that I could easily have been one of them.
And then that is also comes forward with the story that you have about your sister. Your sister was born on your 18th birthday. You were given the honor of naming her. You say she uncannily resembles you, but she has a profound and striking difference. Almost I got the sense of an alter ego, of a sense of, you know, a doppelganger through the looking glass.
Yes, it's true. If you look at it in the mythic terms, my sister has very, very extreme autism. She suffers from autism. She's never spoken a word. She doesn't understand words, and she doesn't recognize anyone. She doesn't recognize even my brother, who goes to see her fairly often. So it's a terrible tragedy, and I think the whole phenomenon of autism is being studied and understood today in a way that's helpful. But 50 years ago, it was completely unknown.
So finally now, you're on the book tour with this memoir. Do you see another memoir ahead of you?
I don't see another memoir ahead of me, not at the moment. This was really sort of painful to write, and I felt sad. I felt sad when I ended it, and so I'm not sure that I'm able to write another one.
Well, Joyce Carol Oates, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Joyce Carol Oates' new memoir is The Lost Landscape. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt. Next up, we listen again to my 2014 interview with Ann Patchett. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On our show today, two of America's most celebrated writers, Joyce Carol Oates and now Ann Patchett. I spoke with Patchett in 2014 about her collection of essays, most of them personal in nature, or about the writing process. The book is This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Well, Ann Patchett, welcome to Writer's Voice. This collection of nonfiction writings, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Some of the pieces are about writing, some are just about life, some are new, some are old. Why did you make that the title story?
Because it was a good title. You know, I really thought about all the different titles, and, you know, I could retitle something if it would work best as a title. For a long time, I was going to call the book The Mercies after the last piece, and that wasn't quite strong enough. But on one hand, I think that This is the Story of a Happy Marriage is a terrifying title because, of course, it's like saying my children are beautiful and love me and have no interest in methamphetamine. You know, it's kind of bringing the evil eye onto yourself in a way. But I also thought, as a bookstore owner, I thought, boy, if I walked into a bookstore and saw a book that said this is the story of a happy marriage, I would pick it up. And I also think that it became a book about all of the things I was married to. It's a story about all the different things in my life I'm committed to, family, friends, books, work, dogs, and so it seemed to work.
Usually on this show, I talk to writers about their books, which are not about writing, and sometimes we talk a little bit about writing at the end. But here's a chance to talk to a wonderful novel writer about a wonderful piece, The Getaway Car.
That was a funny story. I was giving a talk in Chicago, and a woman followed me into the bathroom. It was right before I went on. And she said, I work for Byliner, and I didn't understand what Byliner was. I didn't understand what Byliner was, I don't think, until after the piece came out. She said, I really want you to write a very long format essay. And that was right about the time I was starting to think about doing this book, and I was wanting to write some longer pieces. But it was also just really funny because I was about to go on and do this presentation, and this woman was pitching me in the bathroom, basically, to write this piece. And she said, yeah, I said, what do you want me to write about? She said, anything. It just needs to be really long. So I thought about what it was that I wanted to say for 50 pages. And I went on to give this talk, and I was talking a lot about writing, and people were asking me a lot of questions about writing. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, I'll basically write about this, all of these things that I'm asked no matter where I go. And my dream, and this has actually really worked, is that I would answer every single question that people have ever asked me about writing, so that when somebody comes up and asks me those questions, I can now say, give me your email address. I wrote this really long essay called The Getaway Car, and I'll send it to you. And it's really served me so well in the year since I wrote it. Because people will say to me all the time, you know, will you have lunch with my daughter? She's a freshman in college, and she really wants to be a writer. Will you meet with my son? He's trying to decide if he wants to go to graduate school. And I always say, okay, yes, I will. But first they have to read this essay. And if at the end of reading this essay they have any question for me, I'll meet with them. And never once has anyone wanted to meet with me. I just don't know if that's because they figure I'm so boring that they wouldn't actually want to have lunch with me after they read the essay, or if I did, in fact, manage to do what I set out to do, which is I answered all the questions.
And I really think you did. So let's start at the beginning. So starting a novel, you have a wonderful description about how you live with a novel first. And tell us about that.
I do, and I am right now. I have a novel in my head that on one hand is pretty much ready to go, although there's a whole sort of chunk in the narrative arc I haven't figured out. But I find this part of the process the most pleasant. When I'm just walking around and kind of thinking about things, you know, it's the difference between fantasizing about your wedding when you don't have a boyfriend and planning a wedding or getting married. You know, one is a very dreamy, happy experience, and one is really miserable. And I think that the actual work of writing can be really miserable, but the dreamy planning is lovely. And I'm always kind of happiest when I feel like I have a good idea for a novel and I can kick it around in my head, but I'm not actually sitting down and doing the work of it.
Also, you talk about how you got into this. I mean, first you almost always knew that you wanted to be a writer, and then you went to college and studied mostly short story writing. You also studied with some pretty amazing people. Grace Paley. Tell us a little bit about studying with her.
Grace Paley was just... I still can't believe that I spent a year with Grace. And that's the thing, these classes at Sarah Lawrence, they were a year long, and there were, I don't know, 12 or 14 people in the class. It was really small, and you stayed with these people all year. And Grace's attention was very hard to get. She was often gone saving the world. She had her eyes on much larger issues than our short stories, and I felt often hurt and neglected, and I was a quiet student and also somebody who always got my work done on time, and I always did exactly what I was told. I was the product of 12 years of Catholic girls' school, so going to Sarah Lawrence was a funny experience for me. But Grace really did have a larger lesson, which was keeping your eye on the problems of the world was a much more important calling than writing a short story, which I think is why she didn't turn out a large body of work in her life. But she led a very important life, and the stories that she wrote, I think, are essential. They're just breathtaking. She put so much focus and life and light and energy into everything that she did write, but she also raised two kids and had two marriages and worked tirelessly for peace, be it on the neighborhood level or on the world level. And that was the lesson she had to teach us. You know, she wanted us to be better people, more interesting people, so we would be better writers.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ann Patchett about her marvelous collection of essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It's out from HarperCollins. And that leads into also something that Russell Banks told you, who you also studied with.
Yeah. Russell told me, and Russell, I see Russell, you know, every couple of years, and he always says, I have no remembrance saying this to you. But he said, you have to make the decision if you want to write great art or great television. He said, you know, you're a really good writer. And I was 20 at the time. He said, you're a really good writer. Nobody else in class is ever going to criticize your work, but you're shallow, you're facile. And the only person who can make you go deeper and make you do better work is you. I can't do it. Other kids in the class can't do it. You have to want something more for yourself. And it was one of those moments where someone kind of hits you and then everything changes. And I walked out of that meeting into a different world and thought, I don't have any interest at all in writing great television. And I don't know that I ever went on to write great literature, but at least that's the direction I've been shooting in ever since. And that's really because of him. I mean, maybe I would have come to that lesson later, but I feel when people give you that kind of advice, what they're really doing is saving you years and years of wandering around in the dark. And I appreciate that because it really feels more than anything like the gift of time. Yeah, I might have come to that on my own eventually, but you saved me that by just telling me.
And so what did you feel? I mean, you obviously took that lesson to heart, but was there some trepidation? Was there some sense that, can I go deeper?
No, there was no trepidation. I knew I could. I knew exactly what he was saying, and I knew he was right. You know, and life is like that all the time. I mean, if you're wearing an unflattering outfit or if you've made a dinner that really isn't very good, and if somebody calls you out on it, you're like, yeah, I knew that. I knew I wasn't doing my best work. And obviously, if I had been doing my best work and I was shallow and facile, then I wouldn't have understood what he was talking about, and I wouldn't have been able to change it, and it wouldn't have made any sense to me. But because the criticism was so crystal clear to me, I really could just get to work on it immediately. I have always known about myself that I could have made a fortune in advertising. I have a brain that is particularly well-suited to jingles and stupid copy. I mean, I just would have been so good at that, at selling the world products they didn't want. I live in Nashville, and I have a friend, somebody that I've known for 15 years, who lives in the neighborhood, and we walk our dogs together. And he is a song producer, music producer, and he writes country music songs. And so sometimes we'll be complaining about our work, and I'll be complaining about how hard it is to write the novel I'm writing, and he'll be complaining about how hard it is to write the song he's writing. And I'm always saying, oh, Wally, give me a break, man. You're writing 3-minute rhyming couplets. This is not rocket science. So about 6 months ago, after years of talking about this, Wally finally said to me, come on, you know, let's write a song, put your money where your mouth is, let's see if you can do it, smarty. And it turns out I'm really good at it. I'm really good at writing about you've been out all night and you're cheating and days are through and I'm putting your bag on the doorstep, because I'm really good at writing crap. And Wally keeps saying to me, this is unbelievable. You've got to do this all the time. We could just make a fortune. You're a gold mine. And it's not my calling.
Well, thank goodness for that.
It is really fun, though. You can really be stuck on a novel and pick up the phone and say, okay, Wally, let's write some really trashy country song. Let's go.
So that explains why you were able to write for 17 magazine and do freelancing, not because you were a writer, but precisely because you wanted to write other things. I think a lot of people would say, well, gee, if you're writing all day as a freelancer, how did you possibly have the emotional energy to write fiction?
I wish we were on television so you could see me roll my eyes, but it's like writing a grocery list. I mean, if I'm writing pieces back in my 20s, I was writing for 17 magazine about how to decorate your locker or, you know, when the chemistry isn't there. That does not take away from fiction writing. You know, I was also a cook in a restaurant and later a waitress in a restaurant. That took away from fiction writing because I was just too tired at the end of the day to do anything. But I could turn out stupid articles about bridesmaids' dresses all day long, and it didn't take away from anything. It was so easy.
And your mom, you kind of had a perhaps some kind of a model, I guess, because your mother is also a writer, and we've interviewed her on the show, Jean Ray. And she's also a nurse, a full-time nurse. Now that, I would imagine, would be hard to put together.
Well, of course, Mom's career didn't actually turn out that way. She was a full-time nurse, and she wanted to retire, and she didn't have the money to retire. And this is actually a very funny aside. My mother was the office nurse for the guy that I wound up marrying. So that's how I met my husband. He was my mother's boss. And my mother was wanting to retire. She was 60, and she was looking at the future, and she just didn't have enough money to retire. And we were talking about all the different things she could do, and I kept saying, you need to write a novel. You know, you've always been really funny, and you're smart, and you were always a good writer, and we can do this. And so that's what she wound up doing. And I was my mother's personal trainer and bullied her a lot and kept saying, where's chapter four? I want to see chapter four. And that was how she was able to quit nursing. So my mother really wasn't writing all those years mm-hmm. that I was growing up and while she was nursing, but she always had it in her.
Right. We're talking with Ann Patchett about her marvelous collection of essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It's out from HarperCollins. So we've talked about practice.
Mm-hmm.
You got to stick your butt to the chair every day.
Right.
you also talk about forgiveness.
Yeah, that's huge. And I think that is a real skill that I have that a lot of people don't have, which is no matter what you write, it's not ever going to be as good as what's in your head. And it's writing is a heartbreaking process in that sense, because I know the book that I have in my mind right now that I haven't started writing is so brilliant, is so wonderful. And once I start writing it, it's not going to be anymore. And it's going to break my heart. I'm going to break my heart. And the fact that I can say, this isn't what I want. This isn't the book that I can envision, but this is the best I can do. And always really doing my best, which was also a big transition point in my life, probably when I was about 25, that I finally decided to put writing first and to do my best work. because before, you know, it was always I was breaking up with somebody or I was broke or I had to move. There was always some reason why I could look at the story I had just written and say, well, you know, it's okay, but it's not really my best work. And the advantage to doing that is if you know that you're not doing your best work, you don't know if you're 1% away or 90% away from your best work. So if you don't feel like you're doing your best work, you don't ever have to confront how bad you might actually be, or mediocre, or whatever. And so when I finally decided, okay, I'm going to start doing my best work, I also had to confront, you know, the fact that I was not Chekhov. I was not a genius. I was good, but I wasn't great. And I would have liked to have gone through my life believing that I was great, but instead I did my best work and I forgave myself for it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, you know that we are talking with Ann Patchett, novelist Ann Patchett, about her most recent book, which is a collection of essays, and it's This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. So when you're saying do your best, what are some of the elements, other than just parking your butt in the chair, what are some of the other elements of doing your best?
I think for me, and it would be different for everybody, but it's just a matter of calling myself out and writing a sentence and thinking, you know, that could be better. One thing that's really important to me at this point in my life, and I'm going to be 50 in a couple of months, is I'm so aware of time. I am aware of my own time. And I don't mean just, you know, as we hurtle through space towards our own death, although that's part of it, but I'm really busy. And I know everybody is really busy. And so if I'm going to write something, I want it to be worth your time. I want to say something that is in some way essential to me. And when I was 20, 25, 30, I didn't feel that way. I just felt like I was young and I was so interesting and everything I had to say was worth your time. I don't feel that way at all anymore. And when I sit down to write, I find myself constantly paring things down, wanting to get to the point as never before. You know, can I say this beautifully but in the fewest number of words? Because I have something I want to tell you, but I really don't want to take your whole day because I know how busy you are. And that, for me right now, is a big part of doing my best. And that's my dog, Sparky, barking in the background. He's also doing his best.
And you have some lovely, one lovely story, and she also appears in another story, Rosie.
Yeah.
Another dog of yours. You know, I just wonder if you would share something about her with our audience.
Well, we had Rose for 16 years, and she was, you know, my life. I really realized she was the being that I had spent more hours with than I had any other being in my life, more than my mother, more than my husband, more than my best friend, because I work at home and we were always together. She was a little white terrier chihuahua kind of mutt that we found. And when I first got her, I was writing a lot for Vogue back then, and I wrote a piece about getting a dog and about being a woman who really didn't want to have kids but loved having a dog and how people tend to mess that up. Then years go by, and I stopped writing for Vogue, and they called me right after Rose had died. And I had really been thinking about writing about Rose, but I didn't, about her death, but I didn't know how. And Vogue called me. I hadn't written for them in probably 10 years. And this editor, who I had not worked with before, said, you know, we're doing this anniversary issue. We want to get all of our favorite writers back in the magazine. We want you to write the front piece for this issue. And I said, well, what do you want it about? He said, well, ideally, we would like a piece that was like that piece you wrote about getting your puppy, because that was the most popular piece we ever ran. You know, we had more mail about that piece than anything else. And I said, oh, well, my puppy just died. so should I write about that? And he was like, great, that would be perfect. And that was the kind of thing, and this is so often the case with me with nonfiction, I really needed an assignment. I couldn't just sit down and write it unless I was writing it for somebody. And it was to write about Rose's death was very, very difficult for me because I am a very cheerful, emotionally stable person, which is just the luck of the draw, my brain chemistry, what I came in with. And when she died, and she died at 16, I mean, just she had a fantastic life, I fell into this really crippling sadness. And I was so surprised. I knew she was going to die. I knew she was 16. That's the way it worked. But it was worse than kind of anything that I could have imagined. And I know that that's true for a lot of people, but it felt embarrassing to say, you know, my dog died, and I was in such a deep grief over it that it just completely knocked the breath out of me for months. So anyway, because I had agreed to write this piece and I had a deadline, I did it. I figured it out. How can I say this and sound credible to myself? And so many people, it's a piece that got passed around, so many people come up to me in the bookstore and say, oh, I read that piece about your dog dying. It was so helpful to me. My dog died. Or somebody will say, can I get a copy of that? I have a friend whose dog died. It was the only thing that really helped me when my dog died. And that's beautiful. I mean, that then I feel like, okay, my job on this earth is done if I've given somebody else some comfort from that horrible experience. It helps me make sense of the experience.
And did it help you too?
Did it help me?
Mm-hmm. To write that.
No, it didn't help me. It didn't help with my grief to package it and write it, but it helped me to hear that it helped other people. And I do find with so many of these essays, when I went back and was reading through old essays, and there were hundreds of them, and I never really realized this, but the essays are where I put things. Happiness and sadness and poignancy, more than anything, that I can't carry it with me all through my life. So I put it down in writing, and then I put that away. And so I can say, oh, you know, there's the sadness over my friend Lucy or my grandmother dying or when my husband and I were dating and we broke up, but then we got back together. Those are experiences you just don't have the time and energy to go back and touch those again and again over the course of a day. But it's almost like I stick it in the pages of a book, like a leaf, and I press it. And I think, okay, now it's there. I know where it is.
Ann Patchett, speaking with me in 2014 about her collection of essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. Next week, we spend the hour with Carl Safina Next week, we spend the hour with marine biologist and environmental writer Carl Safina about his wonderful new book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.